from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The impact and consequences of this legislation will affect every Illinoisan, every worker, every employer, public, private, nonprofit, charity, you name it. But today, February 14th, this rush, and I repeat, this rush to pass this bill is nothing less than breathtaking.
Contrary to what you may hear, what we've already heard, as a matter of fact, today, the bill has been negotiated and deliberated over the course of years, including bringing in feedback from many people who had concerns about the bill.
I even argue that $15 is actually not sufficient according to economics of what we actually should have as a minimum wage in Chicago or the rest of the state of Illinois.
The original architects of the 25-year-old plan calculated that in 2020, Illinois taxpayers would pay $4.9 billion in pensions. Instead, that same plan now calls for us to pay $9.1 billion. That's nearly double what was expected. It's unsustainable, and frankly, it's not fair. It's not fair to parents who today need childcare and students who deserve a good education. It's not fair to those who rely on social services or to providers who wait months to be paid for delivering them.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker's top budget aide, Dan Hines. He's talking about a plan that would at least temporarily reduce what the state is contributing to its already underfunded pension systems. Also, you heard state lawmakers in there discussing the minimum wage, and that legislation has passed the General Assembly, and the governor is expected to sign it well before his budget address next week. We will talk about all of that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House Editor, and Daisy Contreras, the IPR State House Reporter. Joining us by phone today from Chicago, Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business. And Greg, it's always good to have you on once again.
My pleasure, as always.
Daisy, I'll turn to you first. You've been following the minimum wage. We've talked about it for a few weeks now. Weren't sure if it was going to happen as quickly on the fast track that the Democrats had been pushing for. It did happen, and the governor has now indicated he will sign this legislation.
Yeah, and that would make Illinois the first state in the Midwest to approve a $15 minimum wage increase. And that's, of course, after Governor J.B. Pritzker signs it. And yes, this fast track approach has been the ire of many Republican lawmakers and several business groups over the last few days. Earlier in the week, we saw business groups like the Illinois Retail Merchants Association bringing in business owners to the state capitol, trying to convince Democrats that they needed more time on the negotiating table. They wanted to reach some type of compromise where the phase into $15 an hour would be spread out over maybe more than the 6 years that it will be, or maybe have like this tiered approach to the minimum wage depending on region. But as we heard at the top of the hour, advocates say they have been negotiating this for many, many years. A similar bill was passed out of the General Assembly 2 years ago. Then Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed it. So they said, you know, everyone has had enough time to come to the table and express their concerns. And now some Republicans are upset that the governor is not keeping true to his word, a promise that he made in his inauguration speech, that he would work with both sides of the aisle, that he would try to compromise on issues affecting the entire state. And this was one of the big issues.
Well, he did say, though, that mm-hmm. he did favor this and was going to push for this. So,
exactly.
So you could
yes.
argue he's being true to his word by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's $8.25 an hour now. And it will take all the way till 2025 to get to $15 an hour.
Yes, so we will see the first increase next year, January, the second in July of that same year to reach a $10 minimum wage. And then every year after that until 2025, it will be $1 per year. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell how this will pan out. The biggest question, I think, is how much will this plan cost the state when it comes to paying state workers? And one number that I heard thrown around during debate on Thursday was $60 million. Governor Pritzker has pointed out that his budget proposal next week will account for any of the costs and to have a balanced budget. So we will see.
And these are a lot of state workers, things like home health care workers, people like that, and also some people at students and those working at universities, correct, Charlie?
Yeah, it would Well, it would cover everybody in the state of Illinois. And the cost for next year's budget, we have to remember, because the increase doesn't kick in until January 1st, the fiscal year starts on July 1st. So whatever is in the 2020 budget will only be half of what the full year cost will be once it's annualized. And I would guess probably the people who are more likely to be affected by this aren't folks who are actually on the state payroll, but rather people who work for the human services providers, who most of them non-for-profit organizations, who contract with the state to provide human services.
Well, Greg, business groups have been able to fight back on this for a while, and not just here, but in some other states. Didn't happen this time, despite a pretty good lobbying effort against it. What was the difference here?
Well, I think the difference is you have Democrats now running the world in Springfield. You have supermajorities in the House and the Senate. You have a Democratic governor. That's hard to run against or hard to block, particularly when this governor very loudly declared during his campaign that he was going to do this. This is his top priority. They had to raise a stink about it, but they should have known that it was going to be difficult, that this governor had to deliver on this promise early. The question now is whether that lack of influence on this issue translates to lack of influence on other issues. And I'd say the signs are not very good, but it's still early.
And Brian, as Daisy had mentioned there, we thought there might be a little bit of a kumbaya moment to start the new administration, that honeymoon period where Democrats and Republicans say they're going to work together. Does this pretty much drive a nail through that?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always that rhetoric at the start of a new administration. We heard that certainly from Governor Pritzker. We heard that from Governor Rauner about these are common sense ideas that the people want. The difference is that Governor Pritzker, when he started trying to muscle through his agenda, he found that he had fellow Democrats to work with, which is where Governor Rauner came in. He had to try and work with Democrats, but he was pushing Republican ideas. So, I mean, that does make all the difference. Whether there's still room to negotiate, this is sort of an inevitable thing, and this was maybe one of the easier things that Pritzker had to do when you look at the difficulties of the agenda that he has put forth for himself. A lot of things are going to require coming up with additional money, and that could be an even tougher vote with stronger opposition. And ultimately, there have been a number of attempts to sort of calculate out what this means. I mean, the so-called fight for 15 has been going on for a number of years now, and already inflation is taking a bite out of, you know, what the value of that $15 minimum wage is. When it finally arrives in the year 2025, it's going to be worth even less. It's a significant change, but I don't think it's something that the opposition felt like this was going to be the be-all, end-all thing that they wanted to go to war on.
Yeah, and speaking on this idea of compromise and the lack of it that some Republicans are saying, in a very interesting moment during the House debate on Thursday, House Minority Leader Jim Durkin, and I think we heard that at the top of the hour, he stood up to talk and the chamber went quiet, and he expressed his disappointment over what he called, a lack of compromise. And he said, and I quote, "Shame on me for having this optimistic attitude."
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, and I would suggest that this, wanting to write the obituary for compromise is a little premature. It occurs to me, for example, one of the big things that the legislature and the governor will do this spring is a capital program, public works. That will be a bipartisan effort. Republicans will get projects in their districts. There will be plenty of room for Republicans at the bargaining table on that stuff. So there will be a lot of areas where they can work together. But to suggest that somehow or other Pritzker was going to back off on one of his major campaign pledges, considering the margin by which he won the election, considering the fact that the Democrats increased their majorities in the General Assembly, and the Democrats in the legislature had passed this issue before only to have it vetoed, I mean, to expect that this wasn't going to happen or if there were going to be significant changes, I think that's kind of unrealistic.
I do think it's worth taking a step back here, because this is not the sort of thing that has sailed through easily. I mean, Democrats had unified control of the government throughout the early part of this decade, and they still didn't, the minimum wage was where it's been since, 2010?
2010, yeah.
Yeah, 2010 is the last time that there was an increase. And, you know, there was talk, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement happened in 2011. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about doing things like raising the minimum wage. And Democrats didn't do it because they had maintained good relations with the business community and wanted to take those concerns seriously. So this is a new era. And I do think it's worth noting that I am a little, I don't know, I don't want to say surprised, but I think it's something that's notable to see how quickly the, you know, the party kind of took a turn to the left in its rhetoric in the last couple of years, and now it's following through with action on that.
Well, you're right, but Pritzker had to do this. But that having been said, I think there's been some people have been offended here on this one, but I don't think any bridges have been burned yet. But I don't think this augurs well for relations between the business community and Pritzker. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff, as Charlie correctly pointed out, that's still to come.
And Daisy, before we move on here, I wanted to ask you, we have discussed in the past few weeks this idea of splitting the state a bit, you know, having a minimum wage for different parts of the state. Some other states have done that as well. That idea just didn't get any traction?
No, they didn't. Will Guzzardi, the House sponsor, a Democrat, said that it was taken into consideration, but it just wouldn't be a fair approach to the minimum wage and lifting people out of poverty as a way to help them get out of poverty. It had to be across the board, across the state.
And again, the governor expected to sign that legislation next week. Before he delivers his budget, his first real major address will be made on Wednesday. I guess a combined state of the state budget speech. He's already made it clear the state has some serious fiscal problems. And Greg, what do we expect to hear from the governor next week?
Well, we got a big tip-off this week on the single biggest issue, which is how we're going to deal with the pension problem, which is what's really eating up the state budget. It's now Dan Hines, the governor's chief budget aide, noted in a speech up here earlier in the week that the pension costs used to make up 3% of general state spending. It's now up to 20% of state spending, and we're not catching up. We're actually a little further behind every week, every year, so the question is what we do with it. Well, Hines laid out his plan, and I frankly was a little disappointed about it. There was an awful lot of can kicking. There was a bit of a holiday that's going to give the new governor some budget relief next year, $800 million, which I'm sure he'll use to pare down the size of the $3.2 billion estimated budget hole. I think that's going to be a central element. I think we'll also find out on the 20th, are we going to have a capital bill? And if so, how are we going to pay for it? And I think we may get some clues as to what the governor's spending priorities are, who's going to get more, who's going to get less, who's going to stay where they are.
Well, taking what's known, I guess, as a pension holiday, Charlie, pushing, as Greg mentioned, kicking the can down the road a bit, I can understand the need to do that because, you know, you still have some bills you've got to pay, some things you need to do right now. Is it a good idea to go this route?
I think it depends on how it's structured. If we were to do what happened with Rod Blagojevich in his first year, where we sold, I believe it was $10 billion worth of bonds, ostensibly to help out the pension system, and then we spent like 30% of it on operational costs, that's not a good idea. On the other hand, if we were to sell bonds dedicated purpose only to add to the pension assets, and the interest rate on the bonds would be less than the interest we're paying on the unfunded liability, that would be, I think, a reasonable approach. And also, I think this whole notion about reamortization is not that bad an idea, because as Hines noted in the clip that we heard, things have changed dramatically from 25 years ago when this plan was first put in place. And in fact, if we were to stretch it out over a longer period of time, in a way it would be like a homeowner refinancing the mortgage.
Well,
because you have to remember, though, the unfunded liability extends out into time, and I suppose in a sense it would go on to infinity. It never has to be paid, all of it in one fell swoop.
Right, because not everybody will retire at the same time.
Yeah, not everybody's going to retire at the same time. And if the state would end, we'd have, you know, we'd have bigger problems to worry about it than people's pensions.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, the two things. One, Charlie is right that there is a small pension obligation bond issue that's proposed as part of this $2 billion. And unlike Blagojevich's pension obligation bond. This governor says that he will use that, put that money right into the pension fund. He's not going to use it as an offset against what the state normally contributes. So that's a step forward. On the other hand, this argument that, give us a few more years and we'll catch up down the road, but in the meantime we'll have to put in a little less right now so I have more money for my budget. We've heard this song before. We heard it from Pat Quinn. We heard it from Jim Edgar. We heard it from George Ryan, and we never seem to catch up. And the fact of the matter is we need to get off this ramp where we have to keep increasing what we put in every year, but we never catch up. And finally, bite the bullet and come up with a big chunk of money so that we at least can get to a level funding scheme where as the budget grows, it doesn't all have to go into, and revenues go, it doesn't all have to go into pensions. It can go to schools and roads and the other stuff we need. But, you know,
we never
seem to catch up. It's always, we're going to do it a little bit further. Now we're going to do another 7 years.
Is it that part of the re-amortization instead of 2045?
I don't know.
Isn't that part of the re-amortization plan, though, to try and get to where we have level payments, just like
eventually. But if they're going to go to a level payment scheme right now, they didn't say that. I would hope that would be part of it. But if you're going to reduce what you put in by $800 million from what the statutory level, which is what they say they're going to do, that's not level payment. That's dropping the payment now, and obviously you have to pay it again. Later, only you have to pay it and the interest and all the lost money you have for not having the money in the stock market making money.
Which is why we got in the hole we're in.
And that's exactly what I was going to point out. You know, I too have used that analogy that Charlie used about the mortgage and re-amortizing the mortgage. But another way to think about this is like your retirement fund. And if you start investing at age 30, maybe you can invest, I don't know, just pick a number, $10,000 a year and count on that to grow and maybe be enough, you know, to supplement your whatever Social Security when you're older. If you wait until you're age 40, well, then you got to maybe kick in $15,000 a year. If you don't start contributing enough until you're age 50, suddenly you got to start coming up with more and more money because you are foregoing all those years of investment growth. And Hines had a comment in his speech about, you know, talking about the so-called pension ramp that was passed in the 90s, where he said the flaws only became evident when markets got shaky and we realized that people were going to be living longer. Well, I think the inevitability of market downturns occasionally happening and, you know, the general upward trajectory of people's life expectancy are not trends we expect to change in the near future. And so, you know, again, shorting the funding now just compounds the problem and means that we're going to have to come up with even more money down the line.
Brian, I think Dan Hines, I mean, we all have covered him through the years, and, you know, he always has struck me as a pretty smart fiscal fellow, and I think he does understand probably the risks associated with this. But is the political risk of not putting money in there the same as the political risk of not necessarily being able to fund certain programs or, you know, get your arms around some of the bill payments that the state needs to make? There's some benefit, I guess, you know, at the same time, there's going to be risk and people are going to say you're kicking this can down the road. But if you don't do it, you're not going to be able to do certain things either.
Well, this is the crowding out argument, and it's really the sort of liberal case for pension changes, pension reform, if you want to use that phrase, which is that every dollar you're putting into the pension system is not money you are spending on classrooms and state police cars and other things like that, healthcare that the state does. And so, you know, another way to look at this is it's a generational transfer, right? People enjoyed a high level of services from the state government of Illinois for decades and did not pay for what that cost at the time, because instead of, you know, adjusting a tax rate, having the income tax be what it would take to fund things, we shorted the pension systems. And so we kick that can down the road, to continue abusing that metaphor. This is something where I think, as Greg said earlier, you need a big chunk of change. We've had a number of proposals in recent years. There was, I think it was some economists at the Chicago Fed who proposed a statewide property tax. You know, we had the Civic Federation has a proposal out in the last week or two. The commercial, the executive committee of the commercial club, civic committee of the commercial club, something like that.
On that point, we should probably touch briefly on what Pritzker offers as the potential solution to all that. That's as he put it in announcing a formation of a Blue Ribbon Committee that's going to study this the other day. He wants to consider repurposing or sale of state infrastructure and real estate assets. Some of that, it just makes common sense. The state has 20,000 fewer employees than it used to a few years ago, but we still have all the leases and office space and whatever that those people occupy. So, hey, if we can give that to somebody else, sell to somebody else, sublease to somebody else, we're ahead. On the other hand, they've notably not taken off the table doing something with the Illinois Tollway, which could be very controversial because you've got a tollway that largely operates in suburban Republican areas, but you've got a state that's now run largely by Chicago Democrats. So that could end up being quite a little pushing match, but there's no question there's some real money there if they leased it, if they sold it, if somebody had raised the tolls a whole bunch so that you could drive up the price. All those would help the state budget, but it could be very controversial politically.
Greg, also, we've talked here about some of the ways the state could possibly save money, raise money. Are there any discussion about the additional revenue from maybe taxes or the possibility of some major cuts in this budget? Have we heard anything about that?
We have heard that they all seem to be in favor of taxing legalized sale of marijuana for recreational use. We're going to see some money there. We've heard more talk than usual about more money from gaming. They talked about saving money by consolidating downstate pension funds mostly. Every little police and fire department has their own pension fund, and you could save a lot of money on overhead if you threw them all together. That's on the table. The one thing that seems not to be on the table is trying to do anything at all on the pension benefit side, despite some pressure from the civic groups up here about let's reopen the Illinois Constitution and do something with the 3% compound annual COLA that most pensioners now get. This governor has made it real clear he doesn't want to talk about that. Democrats seem of a mind, so I wouldn't expect to see that in the budget proposal, but I would expect to hear Republicans talk about it.
Well, and I would argue that that's pretty futile in my judgment. That kind of just distracts from the real issue. We've tried to reduce benefits. The Supreme Court said unanimously you can't cut benefits. You can't even cut the promises you made for health care to retirees. So I think that's, in a way, that's kicking the can down the road by distracting people from the reality of it. We have reduced benefits for new hires. The people who got hired after, I think it was January 1st, 2011, mm-hmm. have much worse benefits than, for example, I do, who signed on with the university back in 93, or Sean, who signed mm-hmm. on in
late
the
90s.
90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On the other hand, somebody like Daisy would have fewer benefits because she came here after that change. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you can do anything going forward, but you can't do anything with a huge unfunded liability. You could change the pension systems going forward so that the normal cost, the value of the benefits earned in a particular year, would be less, but you can't do anything about the unfunded liability. You could change the Constitution. You could wipe out the pension protection clause and still would not make the debt go away.
And Brian, real quick before we move on here, your thoughts on what you're expecting to hear from the governor next week?
Yeah, I don't have much to add to everything that's already been said. I mean, he's been softening the ground for this. I think the one thing we haven't touched on is he is going to be, we expect, to talk about a graduated or progressive income tax. This is where, of course, higher levels of income are taxed at a higher rate. It's something that he views as the big sort of solution. As we know, there's no immediate relief from that. Assuming it gets through the legislature, it has to go before the voters in November of 2020. The earliest we would start seeing revenue from that would be after it would be approved by the voters, if the voters approve it. And I think he is still going to talk about it, and then we are going to see, I would expect, a lot of money on both sides of that fight trying to persuade Illinois voters to accept or reject the idea.
And just very quickly before we move on, adding to the whole Pritzker ideas on how to bring in more revenue, and I think you would need all of these ideas on the table in order to make a dent. We've heard from advocates for legalizing recreational marijuana and expanding gambling, like sports gambling. Those things will not bring in too much revenue. So, you know, people are looking at those ideas as the best things for the state for revenue, but it'll be very small.
I wanted to save about a minute or two here at the very end to talk about someone who passed away this week, Lyndon LaRouche. You might remember he was 96 years old, ran for president several times, I believe once from prison. You might call him a conspiracy theorist. And to be honest, he wouldn't really be that known here in Illinois except for something that happened in 1986, Charlie.
Yeah, I was at the Sun-Times at the time, and in the 1986 general election, as we headed into it in, you know, the winter of 85-86, there was great expectation because 4 years earlier, Jim Thompson won re-election over Democrat challenger Adlai Stevenson by the closest vote margin in state history, 5,074 votes. And so everyone was expecting another tight race. Lo and behold, in the March primary, two of Lyndon LaRouche's disciples, a guy named Mark Fairchild, a woman named Janice Hart, beat the slated Democratic candidates. Fairchild beat George Sangmeister for lieutenant governor. Hart beat Aurelia Puchinsky for secretary of state. And the reason that they did, because I, like other reporters, did a lot of checking and talking to people after the fact, the Democratic organization, the grassroots people, the precinct workers kind of laid down on the job. They assumed that voters would vote for the slated candidates. And in many instances, people thought, Sangmeister? What kind of a name is that? Fairchild? Oh, that's a lot better. And so they voted for the, quote, American, unquote, sounding name. Or Puchinsky? Holy cow, is she a communist? That kind of thing. And so the LaRouche candidates won those two primary spots. And the significance was that Adlai Stevenson suddenly was paired with a guy who was a disciple of what turned out, or what we thought at the time was really a whack job, this Lyndon LaRouche. So Stevenson resigned the nomination, and the Democrats had no candidate for governor in 1986 general election. Stevenson ran on a new party called the Solidarity Party. He got totally creamed by Thompson, as everybody expected. But to me, it was a lesson that precinct workers can't take stuff for granted. You got to go out and you got to talk up your candidates. You got to let people know who are the, quote, legitimate candidates. As a matter of fact, in my particular precinct here in Springfield, the Democratic precinct committeeman was a hardworking guy, and he was very diligent. And as a result, in my precinct, Puchinsky and Sangmeister ran just a point or two behind Alan Dixon, who at the time was at the top of the ticket.
Well, there you go, the history lesson for the week. And let's go to our notes from the field. Daisy?
The Illinois House voted Thursday to approve Carol Pope as the new legislative inspector general. That is the role responsible for investigating complaints against state lawmakers. Last week, the Senate also voted in favor of her appointment, and she will become the first permanent inspector general in 4 years and will start work in March.
And Greg?
Back on how to solve the state's financial problems, one of the more interesting ideas I heard comes from Bill Daley, the brother of the former mayor who is running for mayor himself right now. He says that since Pritzker may have some problems getting through his constitutional amendment on graduated income taxes with opposition from the political right, that J.B. ought to allow a vote at the same time, another constitutional amendment, on reopening the pension clause of the Constitution. It's legal. That's a question. It does kind of provide kind of a something for both sides of the political argument that might at least get both of these potential solutions onto the ballot in 2020.
That will do it for this week. Members of the broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and Greg Hines. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.